I'll tell you the story of how we found Rabbi Cardozo. Last year I was actually, after the program was over, we were up in the north at a kibbutz for Shabbos with my mother-in-law who's with a tour and my wife and kids, and I saw a gentleman in the shul with a book that looked familiar that I had read and that was in my that I'd read while I was in YU. And he was sitting right near that book and started talking to him. I noticed he had an unusual accent. And I asked him his name and he said, Nathan Lopez Cardozo, Nathan Cardozo. I said, oh, Rabbi Dr. Nathan Lopez Cardozo, the author of this book? He said, oh yeah, I guess so. So as we got a chance to speak a little bit, I figured it would be a tremendous honor to have him come to our program last year. Rabbi Cardozo has written how many books?
10, 12, I'm not sure.
10, 12 books, okay. Actually, there's a recent book came out just 2 months ago or so.
That's right.
And numerous articles, and he's a keynote lecturer, speaker, speaks all over the world. And it's a tremendous zechus for him to join us here. I think what makes it a little bit easier is the fact that Rabbi Cardozo lives in Beit Vegan. So it's local, and we appreciate very much the zechus of having Rabbi Cardozo here. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Could you bring me a little bit of butter? Yep. Okay, thank you very much for this nice introduction. Let me just wait for a moment till your teacher is back. So tell me in the meantime your name.
Cheryl.
You are?
Daniel.
Daniel?
Leah.
Leah.
Rachel.
Rachel.
Allison.
Allison.
Monica.
Monica.
Vina.
Vina.
Oliver.
Paulina.
Hanan.
Hanan. I'm sitting behind you. What's your name?
Mike.
Mike. Javi.
Javi.
Good to meet you. Good to meet you. So you have to get used for tonight to my accent. I'm from Amsterdam, originally from Holland. Already lived for here many years. But, pardon? Your neighbors?
Belgium.
You're from Belgium, huh? So you're close by. So most of you, I suppose, are from America, right?
No.
No? No?
Most of us.
You're from where?
A lot of people
from
Ukraine.
Ukraine? You?
No, I'm from America.
You're from America.
Yeah.
A section of this group is from Russia. Or the
from Russia?
Orbit,
very
Soviet
nice.
Soviet Union.
Soviet Union. But you now live in America?
Majority.
So you will have to get used to my accent. That I'm sorry about that. I won't charge. I won't charge. תודה רבה, thank you. ברוך אתה אדוני אלוהים מלך העולם שהכל נהיה בדברו. Okay, I want to speak tonight with you about a very unusual topic. I hope you are still awake, 9 o'clock, which I hope you find fascinating, as I find it very fascinating. You know, one of the major but most strangest law in our Torah, in our tradition, relates to Shabbat. I suppose that many of you know, and that officially there are 39 melachot, there are 39 kinds of work which you're not allowed to do on Shabbat. They're mentioned in the oral tradition, in the Mishnah. And they tell you exactly, this is not permitted, this is not permitted. There's a whole list of them: building, writing, sewing, all these sort of different things which are part of man's day-to-day necessities if he wants to build his world. On Shabbat, we are not allowed to get involved in them. But there's one very strange one, which is actually the first one mentioned, and that is that you're not allowed to carry on Shabbat. In the public domain. If you walk outside your home, than nearly anywhere in the world, except some places, and I'll tell you in a moment why, you're not allowed to carry anything in the public domain. It has nothing to do with how heavy something is, because it even includes your handkerchief, something which doesn't take any effort, and still it is not permitted. Inside your home, in the garden, or in the garden or the home of somebody else, which is private domain, you're allowed to. Obviously, you're only allowed to carry these things which are somehow related to observing Shabbat. In some places, like New York, like Toronto, or here most of the cities in Israel, there is something which is a long story I shall not go into now, which is called an eruv. An eruv means to say that you build a kind of a fence around the whole city or a part of a city. You fence it off. You then declare it as private domain. There are loads of laws here which I shall not go into. One of them is, by the way, that you must have permission from the non-Jewish authorities, if you live outside Israel, to consider it to be somehow your private domain. And then you're allowed to carry. So you can take your talit to shul, you can take your sidur, your prayer book to shul. But nearly anywhere else outside Israel and outside some places, you're not allowed to carry. I myself, I do not come from a religious home, I come from a very secular home, but when I started to get involved, one of the first things I learned is, on Shabbat you don't carry the moment you walk outside your home. There's a very strange law, this. What is the meaning behind not to carry something, especially when it doesn't take any effort? If the Torah would have said it is forbidden to carry anything above 5 kilo, I would understand, or 10 kilo, because that's really heavy work. But we already know that work in the Torah has a little to do with effort. Because there are other things which don't take any effort, even putting on some light is also not permitted, and it doesn't take any effort at all. It has something to do with man being creative, or man having dominion over the world. He can do with the world whatever he likes. He can use electricity when he likes, and he can put it on and he can put it off. But how does this relate to not being allowed to carry anything, especially something which doesn't indeed take any effort at all? I always wondered about this. I'll give you an insight into this, and what I hope you will do with it is afterwards, or to discuss it or to think about it, because it opens up a whole different world which we normally don't really think about, but which may quite well be worthwhile to give this much more attention in our lives. I will do that in an unusual way. I will take you somewhere else. It has got absolutely, seemingly nothing to do with this topic. And I will try to show you how it actually relates directly to this topic. Also, I would not have expected that, and you probably don't expect that. If you look into Maaseh Bereshit, that is the creation chapter in the Torah, you know that every time there are 6 days there, maybe 6 million years, we shall not go into this now, but anyway, it is divided in six parts. And every time when HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, wants to create something, he always introduces it with a statement. Vayomer Elohim, and God spoke, Yehi Or, let there be light. Vayehi Or, and then there was light. And so it is with all the 6 days. Now, one of these days, we are being told that God introduces, by way of speech, why he speaks is another topic I shall not go into now, but he speaks and he says he's going to create fruit trees. Trees which carry fruit. And the language used there is very strange. Because if you read in Hebrew, it says, Vayomer Elohim, and God spoke, Tatshei Haaretz, let the earth bring forth, Esef, which means grass, Masriya Zera, different kinds of seeds. And then it says after that, Eitz Osei Pri Le Mino. I just repeat that in Hebrew and then I will translate that for you. It says over there, eight spree, which means a tree which produces fruit, or sepri, which produces fruit, lumino, in according to its kind. The language, as you can hear, is very strange, because it is, first of all, a repetition. It says a fruit tree, which is producing fruit, in according to its kind. Well, first of all, why do you say twice that it's producing fruit? And on top of that, in according to its kind. Obviously, any fruit tree will, by definition, produce fruit in according to its kind. An orange tree, an orange. An apple tree, an apple. So Rashi, in his commentary on the Torah, is bothered by this. And he gives a very interesting answer. He says what it means is that the plan was, when God said, I'm going to create these fruit trees, is that the not only the fruit should have a certain taste, but the whole tree should have the taste of the fruit. In Hebrew you say, tam ha'etz ketam ha'pri. That is to say, the taste of the tree is like the taste of the fruit. Meaning that if, for example, you would go to an orange tree and you would cut off a leaf and you would take out the liquid of that leaf and you would taste it, it would have the exact taste as the orange itself. If I would cut off a piece of the main tree, of the wood, and I would put it in my mouth, or I would try to get some liquid out, the liquid would again be in according to its kind, or better, it would be exactly the same taste as the orange itself. The whole tree, therefore, is basically a piece of fruit. That was the original intention. But Rashi continues and says, but that didn't happen. Because if you read a little on in the same pasuk, or the pasuk after that, it says over there only one thing. It says, v'totze ha'aretz eitz ose pri. And the earth brought forth a tree which gives fruit. It doesn't say a fruit tree which gives fruit. It doesn't see a fruit tree which gives fruit in according to its kind. It only says one thing. It says a tree which produces fruit. So Rashi says, what does that mean? And he gives a very strange answer. He says, the reason is this, that the trees did not do what God had commanded them to do. God told them, produce not only a fruit, which is an orange, but make sure that the whole of the tree has the taste of an orange. But, says Rashi, v'hi lo asetake, but the fruit tree did not do that. Very strange statement. And on the end, all what it did was it produced a normal tree which happened to have an orange. So what does that mean? I don't have to tell you and convince you that fruit trees or any tree has any kind of freedom of will to decide how they will ultimately look like. So obviously there is something very profound being said over here. And I think what that probably means is, and I'm not the first one to say this, is that there is a difference between what God planned, that's when he spoke, and what actually happened. Or if I would say it a little bit more philosophical, it means this, that there's a difference between our reality, as we know it. The fruit is a normal fruit, and the tree is a tree, but it hasn't got the taste of the fruit. And what should have been. Somewhere there is a plan, you may call it a dream of God. God really would like the whole tree to have the taste. But the reality of matters are, the reality in which we live is, that is not the case. Obviously it is God himself who creates that problem. He says one thing, and then he does another thing. Seemingly, God is sending a message here, saying, I want you to know one thing. I have a dream about this world, but I know we are not there yet. And I need you, the human being, to help me somehow to achieve that goal. I told you the goal first, then I created something, and it is up to you, or up to both of us, that slowly but surely will come to a point where the whole tree will have the same taste as the fruit. But that's a long way to go. And there's a lot of work to be done to make that dream a reality. So there's a difference between where we are holding now, let's say, and where we should be holding one day. Where we should be holding is that the whole tree becomes the fruit itself. Now we need to think, what is the meaning behind that? What is the philosophy behind it? How can we understand that? Now I'm going to tell you something which I once heard and once read about, which actually comes from another tradition, not the Jewish tradition, but I believe that in there somehow it solves the problem and it will bring out a Jewish idea which we can explain perhaps through this tradition. When I say this tradition, I'm actually thinking about the Chinese tradition. I suppose that you all know there were many, many years ago, many great Chinese philosophers. By the way, one of them was Buddha. Yeah, what we call today Buddhism, which is now more or less a religion. In the olden days, was not at all a religion, it was just a very deep philosophy, particular way of looking to this world. I'm not saying that we agree with that, but there were some very wise observations made by this man called Buddha. Not so much to do anymore with Buddhism as we most of the time know it. Also, there's definitely a relationship. In that philosophy, they speak about the art of walking. And they state, and now you have to concentrate well, that there are two kinds of walking which man can do. In English, we will probably most of the time call them both walking. But if we would be more careful with our language, we would make a difference between walking and strolling. Can anybody tell me what is the difference between walking and strolling? Anybody has a suggestion? If you have to give it a definition, what's the difference?
When you're strolling, you're not really paying attention to your surroundings.
You're not paying attention to your surroundings. That could be true. That is a very important point, but I think it's more or less what you are saying as well. And that is this. The difference between walking and strolling is that if you're walking, you're always walking to something. Yes, you have a goal. I have to get there. Right? I have to have a meeting there. I have to bring this chavilah, this object there, this box which I have in my hand, or this letter, whatever it is. But I have a purpose which is beyond myself. It is also beyond my walking. Because the walking is only the means to get myself or the object to this or that place. I could walk. I can take the bus. I can take the train. I could even fly. There are many other ways of getting there. I decide that I walk. But the walking itself is purely the means of getting to that particular place. So that's walking. If you stroll, strolling means indeed that you don't have to get anywhere. Why? Because anybody who is strolling, like we, for example, do sometimes on Shabbat, right? We can even go in circles. It doesn't matter, because the object of what we are trying to achieve is the walking or the strolling itself. Every step I make is its very purpose. I want to walk for the sake of walking. I'm not walking for the sake of getting somewhere. It doesn't matter where I get. I don't need to get there. I can walk five times around my own home. And all what I do at that moment is that every step itself counts. Because the whole reason why I'm walking is that every step should count. It is the walking itself what I'm interested in. Therefore we call it strolling. But if you are walking, if we correctly use the language, which obviously we don't do today anymore, then walking indeed means to say, I'm always walking to something. Now the Chinese philosophers, and let's see if anybody understands what they mean by that. They said like this, mountains stroll. Can anybody explain that to me, what that means, a mountain stroll? And to help you a little bit, it does not walk.
The only purpose of the mountain is just to stand there, it's not going anywhere.
So what is the purpose of the mountain?
Just to be.
To be, that to be a mountain, right? That's the meaning of it. The meaning is of when they say a mountain is strolling, it means to say there is nothing beyond the mountain itself. The purpose of a mountain is to be a mountain, right? So the mountain doesn't walk, it strolls. That is obviously an allegorical language, but it makes a very strong point here. A mountain is strolling. It does not have to get somewhere. So its walking is obviously allegorical, or its strolling is allegorical. It doesn't move at all. But the very thing that it needs to be a mountain is its very objective. And in that way, they say it is strolling. It doesn't have to get anywhere else. It just has to be a mountain. So then they add to this the following. If you, speaking to human beings, if you do not understand that the mountain is strolling, or walking if you want, then you do not understand your own walking. If you do not understand what it means when a mountain is walking or strolling, then you do not understand your own walking. Anybody can explain that to me? What does that mean?
If you can't differentiate between doing something with a purpose and doing something without a purpose, you never really know if you're ever accomplishing anything.
Yes, that's true. Anybody else?
Right. And that as a human, you don't necessarily always have to be going in a certain direction. Just be.
You just need to be. Exactly. Yes.
Walking is having a purpose. If you don't understand your walks, you don't understand your purpose.
That's right. If you don't know what it means to stroll, which means to say you don't have to be anything beyond yourself, right? Then you haven't really understood what life is all about. Because if you are only a means to get yourself there, or you're only a means to get the object there, and that's the reason why you walk to the other side of the road, then you are yourself nothing more than a means to something outside, external of yourself. So are you busy at that moment doing something which is really you? The answer is no. Because all what I am is like the train, like the bus. I just happen to be an instrument which gets this particular object to that, to the other side. But if I'm strolling, or better, if I behave like a mountain, and the mountain is there only to be mountain, it doesn't have to get anywhere, it doesn't have to bring anything at all, then I, if I would apply that to myself, then it would mean that indeed I understand more or less who I am, because I am for the sake of being. I'm not there for the sake of something else which is beyond myself, or which I'm just the means to get it there.
I think Judaism is different than Buddhism in the idea that for 6 days we are not a mountain. We are, for on Shabbat, we are supposed to be ourselves and not going anywhere.
Right, exactly.
But for the most part, we are supposed to be going somewhere. We're supposed to have hope and moving towards a better day.
Right. So you're quite right. Let's look into this a little bit more. Let me first of all ask you one more question now, or let's go back to the trees, which we spoke about before. On the basis of what I just said, how would you explain what I just told you about the trees? That first it says there must be a tree which produces a fruit in according to its kind. And afterwards, what happens is only that the Torah says one thing. There's a tree which produces fruit. What's the difference between these two trees? One is a tree which actually did not come about, but is in the dream. And the other one is the actual tree. based on what we just said, who could explain me this Rashi? Yes?
I think like the tree is to be and then using the food.
Yes.
To walk with the food and the food has the purpose to like for us to fulfill. Like the tree has the meaning of being there.
The tree, which tree?
The tree that is going to the system comes down from the left.
I know. I think you're getting there. You're not there yet, but you're getting there.
Sorry, can you repeat again what you said?
I'm asking on the base of what we just said about the mountains, let's say about walking and strolling, right? How would you now explain the difference between the first statement where God speaks about the trees, where he says, I will produce a fruit tree which produces fruit in according to its kind? Yes? To which Rashi says, it means to say that the plan was originally that the whole tree is the fruit, right? And what afterwards happens when the tree only produces fruit, but it is no longer in according to its kind.
So I think that the tree is already like, the tree has a two purposes, to be and also to.
Which tree has a purpose? That is? That produces the fruit?
Like
are you speaking about the first tree or the second tree?
No.
That's a big difference. That's a big difference between these two trees.
I think I came a little bit late, so that's why I don't.
Ah, okay. We will forgive you.
What's the reality of what's supposed to happen is that it's supposed to be a tree that is the fruit itself and produces fruit. You know, there's always supposed to be a purpose in what we do. But what actually happens on occasion is that we just take a stroll in life. It's just a tree that makes the fruit, but in and of itself, it isn't the fruit, you know? Like, life is supposed to always have a purpose, but there are times when we don't always make it meaning.
Would you agree or not?
Be the opposite.
I disagree.
Let's hear. Why do you disagree?
The first tree, the tree that is the fruit that it produces,
yes,
is the stroll. Because in and of itself, it is the goal that itself is the goal that it is.
That's right.
The tree that is not the fruit that it produces has the goal of producing the fruit in and of itself is not the fruit.
Yes.
So that it is actually working towards something instead of in and of itself in its essence being what it's working towards.
Exactly. The point is that the first tree, that's the dream tree, right? There, the purpose of the tree is to be the tree itself. Because the whole tree is its purpose. Therefore, the Chinese would say it is strolling. The second tree, which is the actual tree which was created, right? What does that tree do? It is a means to something. What is the means? The means is that it has to produce a fruit. If you could get that fruit in another way, yes, by some artificial form, if as long as it has produces that particular fruit, you're fine. So the second tree is a means to something. So is it walking or is it strolling? It is walking, right? It is walking. The first one is strolling, right? The first one is the purpose in itself. It needs to be, the whole tree is its very purpose. It is like every step which I make when I'm strolling, that is the very thing why it exists. In the second case, it is like I have to take an object to another place where I'm not at this moment. So I take it into my hand and I schlep it there, as we say, right? And I'm just the means, that is, I'm the tree, which is nothing more than producing the fruit because I have to get that object to the other side. Yeah? So that's the difference between the first tree and the second tree. The first tree is strolling, the second tree is walking. Now I ask you, why are you not allowed to carry on Shabbat? I suppose so.
Carrying something is, you carry something with a purpose of bringing from one place to the other.
Right.
And that was the whole, that was one of the passions that I've given. It's the creating, it's the producing of something new. If you turn from one to the other, and you, while you're doing it, you're being that object that is creating a new thing.
Yes, you are, I think you're there, but I want to hear this clear.
Shabbos, you're supposed to go for Shabbatir. You're supposed to go for Shabbos strolls.
Right.
That's what she said before.
I think you were saying this.
She said, plus she said Shabbos you are, because the essence of God is here.
Right.
And you're not supposed to create for, like during the weekday you're creating.
Use another word for creation. Creation is not a good word here because you're not creating anything when you're carrying. But no, what are you doing when you are carrying? You are?
Walking.
You are walking. Right? You're not strolling. You're walking because at that moment you are just there to get the object to this particular place. And what is the whole purpose of Shabbat? That you have to learn how to
stroll.
Which means to say that you have to become like the mountain. There's only one purpose to the mountain, and it's to be the mountain. Right? You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to get there. Because when you get there, you're busy with something external of yourself. Now, that you can do 6 days a week. Well, I'll come to that in a moment. But the ultimate thing, obviously, is Shabbat. Shabbat is the very idea that once and for all, let's say it a little different. Who am I allowed to carry on Shabbat? Who said that? I heard somebody saying that. Yes? Yourself. The only thing which you're allowed to carry on Shabbat is yourself. Because by carrying yourself, you're busy with your essence. With whom you are. I am there to be. Not because I'm an object or I'm a means to get something else besides myself to that particular place.
Just to clarify, the strolling is the better of the two here, right?
Absolutely.
Walking.
No, the strolling is the ultimate object. Yes? But obviously there's a reason why the trees were not produced that way. Yes?
If strolling is the ultimate object for Shabbos, then why are there so many arrows though?
That's an excellent question. I've argued not so long ago that even when there's an eruv, the concept of an eruv to allow you to carry what otherwise would be considered to be a public domain, first of all, you must remember one thing. On a purely halachic level, any official biblical public domain, you can't build an eruv. That what is totally public. We learned this. Anybody knows from where we learned that you're not allowed to carry on Shabbat? Besides that it is mentioned in the Mishnah. What is the case in the Torah itself where you know that they were not allowed to carry on Shabbat? What? Yes, that's true. With the man, right. When the man fell Friday twice, the reason was that they were in the Midbar, in the desert, where they walked 40 years. On Shabbat, they were not allowed to carry any object. And that's from where we learned. And that is also a Midbar. A desert is a typical public domain. It has no borders. It is nearly infinite. Right? So anything which looks like a meat bar in space, that's for example, right? If it's huge, right? Then you can't build an eruv there. That's, by the way, one of the reasons why there is a big problem about New York, about Manhattan. Because there's a difference of opinion between the great halachic authorities if Manhattan can be considered to be a private domain. Yeah? And they have built an eruv around Manhattan. But some rabbis say it doesn't count. Yeah. Why not? Because they say it is so huge that it basically has the status of something similar to a midbar, a desert. And then there's another thing which is not mentioned in the Talmud, but nearly all the other later authorities bring that. They say like this, it is not just depending how big it is, but it's also depending on how many people are walking through the streets within one day. Have you got an idea how many people that needs to be before it becomes a public domain? 600,000. Why?
And that's the amount of Jews that were in the Midbar.
That's right, because there were 600,000 Jews walking through the desert. So the rabbis later, also again the Talmud doesn't say this, the rabbis said later, anywhere like, for example, Manhattan, where there are opinions which say that 600,000 people pass by through the streets in Manhattan every day, they actually walk so many people, therefore they are of the opinion you can't make an eruv there. Also say it's not true, there are enough fences there, and it's not true that there are 600,000 people walking through there, so therefore they declare it can be considered to be something which is not in according to the Torah itself a public domain, and then it may be still public domain by rabbinical law. We shall not go into this because the rabbis created all sorts of fences, but therefore if it is not a biblical public domain, you can then build a eruv, because in any way it is really not a completely public domain. But once something is definitely a public domain, you can build walls and all sorts of other things, it won't help you. And this is a complicated story halachically. There's a lot being written about this particular topic, and I'm sure that you know that in many places, like in Toronto as well and other places, there are always differences of opinion between the rabbis about that. Some say you can do it, some people you can't do it, and it all depends on which rabbi you follow at that moment. But the idea is very clear, I think. The idea is you need to learn to be a mountain. You need to learn to be just for the sake of being, seeing yourself as the very objective of your life and not just as a means to something which is external of yourself. Doesn't mean, by the way, that therefore you should become egocentric. That's not at all the point. The point is that you have to somehow link up with your neshama, let's say. You carry only your neshama, your soul, on Shabbat, because that is your essence. And once in a week, you have to focus internally to yourself and say, wait a moment, I'm more than just an object bringing things to another place. I'm more than just having to make money. I'm more than to do a lot of other things which I have to produce. We produce in the Western world an enormous amount of things, right? But very often we totally forget about who we are. This is, by the way, the danger of technology. That if you give people enormous amount of technology, like we see here in the Arab countries and now in Iran, where people don't know how to carry themselves, and this technology falls into their hands, they become extremely dangerous, because they stay themselves children, and they're playing around with the most sophisticated weapons, and because they are still children who never grew up and never were able to look into their mirror and say, who am I? And what is the meaning of my very existence? What is the meaning of my soul, my neshama? You get enormous problems in the society in which we live. And this is the society, no doubt, which we have created. Nowhere is anybody speaking here against technology or against science. It is all fantastic. But you have to grow with it. And if you don't grow with it, and you stay behind as a little child, and then you get these very dangerous things into your hands, then you can make an enormous amount of problems, and that's exactly the situation in which we find ourselves today. So now you understand a little bit better what could be the reason behind, I only suggest that, behind the very idea that the Torah says, you have to know how to stroll in life. Now there's another thing which we say, and that is, first of all, we sing this in the songs on Shabbat. We say that Shabbat is ke'ein olam haba. It is like the world to come. Now that can also only can mean that after you die, then you go to the world to come. It can also mean the Messianic age. Because somewhere in the Messianic age, right, you know how to live with yourself and to carry yourself and to stroll. Every step you make is the purpose in itself. Because let's put it all in a different direction. We Jews, we say that the person, we wish a person, he shall become at Me'av Esrim Shana, 120 years, right? But then you have the question, let's imagine that somebody is indeed living 120 years. You could still ask the question, and how many of these years did he really live? Right? Because a lot of time you and I am wasting, if that's the right word, and perhaps that's not completely the right word, but I hope you understand what I'm trying to get to, is that we are wasting so much time in our lives by walking instead of strolling, that when you look to the quality of your life, then you have to say out of the 120 years, I lived perhaps 30 years. Because then I did the real thing. The rest I was just moving things around. Moving objects around. Making money, whatever it is. And nobody will deny that it's all very important. But you're also wasting a lot of time that way. Unless, and that's, I think, what the Torah is trying to get to, you learn even to stroll in the weekdays. I'll tell you a story which happened to me several years ago in this country. I was once invited to speak at a sport event where there was a game of people running, and the person who was running the fastest and was getting the fastest to the other side, he won the race. So they asked me that after the one fellow had won the race, if I would say a few words to compliment him. So I said to the people who asked me, I said, I will do so, but you will regret it. And they did. Because I told you what I did. It was all obviously a little bit of this tongue-in-cheek, but I wanted to make that point. I said to this fellow, sure, you won the race, but not for me. I tell you who won the race in my eyes. You know who that was? The fellow who came the last. Who came on the end, perhaps he came half an hour later. You know why? Because the difference is this, that you, who run so fast, so only thing what you were doing is running to get to that place. All the time you were running up till getting to that place, you didn't see anybody because you were running much too fast. You didn't see the flowers. You had only one strange thing in mind, and that is, I have to get there as soon as possible before anybody else. But in the meantime, you lost everything on the way. You didn't see the flowers, you didn't see the people, you didn't see the flags, people standing there. It was all completely gone. You tell me that you won the race. As far as I'm concerned, you completely lost it. But the fellow who walked very slow and took his time and he said hello to everybody, he may have stopped and give somebody a hand and look to a flower, take the flower, and so on. Didn't he live much better? Was he on the end not having a much more qualitative time than the fellow which is running? Here is exactly our problem. And that is that we are living today in a society where everything came down to one idea. Run as fast as you can. And somewhere the Torah is saying, no, you have to learn one thing. First of all, you get Shabbat every week. We Jews especially, we get a Shabbat. And Shabbat is basically a protest. It is a protest against walking. It is a protest against running. It says, take your time. Have a look around. See the flower. See the fellow next door. Say hello. Don't run at any time, because any time you're running, you ultimately will lose out on the quality of the moment when you are running. The steps which you are making are purely a means, and they have to become an end in themselves. This has become an enormous problem in our society. I don't know, I suppose some of you may have heard, it comes to my mind while I speak, there's a very famous psychiatrist, American Jewish psychiatrist, he died already several years ago. He was one of the big ones, he was called Erich Fromm. Have you ever heard that name?
Yeah.
Erich Fromm. Erich Fromm was an outstanding singer. And he wrote a book, he wrote many books, but one of them is a very interesting book, it's worthwhile reading. It's called To Be or To Have. That's the title. To be or to have. And there he makes one point throughout the whole book. And he does it very well. He says, the problem which we have today is that the world in which we live is a world where we are educated to become havers. Everything is pointing in that direction. Wherever you go to school, even university, they tell you on the end of the day, it depends on one thing, how much do you have? If you have a lot, you may become the prime minister or the president of America. If you have a little, you're not going to make it. We have built a society where the havers are the people we look up to. The people we say, wow, they made it. And what we mean is by they made it is they made a lot of money, they made themselves a name, or whatever it is. We never speak about the quality of the lives of these people. We most of the time don't even know. So Erich Fromm, who was not religious but had a strong Jewish background, you can see that clearly, and he mentions that in his book, says that is a complete disaster. As long as we keep on teaching our children, our students, in our whole, even academic world, that the main thing in life is to have much, then we are on the wrong track, because all what we are doing is telling people, if I put it in my words, we're all telling people to run and to walk. But if you are understanding, which he considers, and which he's right about, he says the main purpose in life is not to have, but the main purpose in life is to be, or if you want, to become. But innerly you're growing, you become a more qualitative person. You're growing in the sense that you become more human, you become more ethical, you become more of what life is really all about. And he says one thing which we have completely lost is exactly that problem. Where everybody is busy with having, and you can take any course in university today, there's one course which they don't give, and there's a course called to be. Or if you want to put it in good Jewish language, you can take any course in university, but to become a mensch, as they say, to become a human being, that course is not available. That's a tremendous accusation against the academic world. Because by that we have really done away with the most important thing about what human life is all about. Let me add another thing to that. You ever thought about the following? Erich Fromm mentions that, and he's right. He says there's one word in English of which there is no word in Hebrew. If you look to that word in an English Hebrew dictionary, you look it up, you will see a space empty on the other side. Which word is that? To have. There is no word to have in Hebrew. If I say in Hebrew, I have a wife, what do I say in Hebrew? Yesh li isha. If I translate that literally, it doesn't mean I have a wife, but there is to me a wife. Yesh li yuladim. I don't owe them. I don't have them. I'm standing in a relationship with them. Erich Fromm writes, he says, I don't understand how the English ever came to the statement something like this. This is my physician. This is my doctor. Since when do you owe the doctor? That's what he asked. Yeah? You and I, we don't even think anymore about that because this is our language. It's my doctor, it's my child, it's my wife, it is my this and it is my that. Hebrew says there is no such thing. All what you can have is to stand in a relationship with these people. Or even objects you can't have. The Torah would say you can have a loan for 120 years, but after that, it's all gone. Or you are gone. In fact, he says something else as well, which is very closely related to this. It sounds funny, but it's very serious. He says, I'm a psychiatrist. He says, I get every time people coming to my home or to where I work, and they tell me, some people tell me, you know, Dr. Fromm, I fell in love. And then Dr. Fromm asked the question, Erich Fromm asked, since when can somebody fall in love? You can fall in a pit. You can't fall in love. Fall means a destruction. Fall means I fell into something. Couldn't help it. That's love. So he says, the very fact that the English today uses this and nobody takes notice anymore, because everybody says, oh yes, he fell in love. Totally ridiculous. You can't say this in Hebrew either. The word ahava in Hebrew, by the way, Aramaic, from the Aramaic word hav, hey, bait, which means actually to give. An act of love is actually an act of giving. If you give a lot to a person, the rabbis say, you will start to love that person because you put something of yourself in the other person. And since self-love is very normal and natural, the moment that you make somebody else as part of your own life, you have an opportunity to love that person. But to fall into love is something which is completely foreign to what it should be. But just as to have is complete nonsense, because it all belongs to the world of walking instead of strolling, so you cannot fall in love either. You can be in love, you can grow in love, you can stroll in love, you can't walk in love. Because then it's already becoming external. Why so many marriages today go wrong? Mainly because everybody sees the other person as being a possession. I possess this wife. I possess this husband. As if it is a piece you can move around. So here something very profound is being said. And that is that ultimately one needs to learn that even when I have to take an object to the other side of Manhattan or Jerusalem, I really, and this is very hard, I haven't succeeded yet. Sometimes I succeed, but most of the time I don't succeed. But if I have to go somewhere, I should try to stroll at the same time. Even when I have to get the object there. At least I should take notice on what I'm doing in the meantime. I'm strolling. I'm taking notice of the people who pass by, who say hello, the flower, the park, or whatever it is. I have to try to develop this in myself. Very hard, because we are not educated like that. And to be quite honest, we are not even educated properly like that in Jewish education today, because we nearly never speak about these things. That's a great pity. We speak about a lot of things in Jewish law. They're extremely important, but sometimes we forget the ultimate meaning. The ultimate meaning why we got all these mitzvot, all these commandments, is because every commandment really should teach me how to stroll. Because every commandment is a moment of saying, wait, just don't take this for granted. I'll tell you a debate I once had with a Reform rabbi, who happens to be a good friend of mine. Many years ago, this goes back 30 years ago, so he accused me of being busy with trivialities, and he asked me if I haven't got something more important to do. So I said to him, give me an example. So he says, well, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was at that time the big posek, the big halachic authority in America, just published the responsum where he discusses the question, are you allowed to open a fridge on Shabbat? Because if you open the door of the fridge there, then the hot air gets in and the motor starts working, and you then have caused the motor to work on Shabbat, which is forbidden. So he has a whole responsum about that. One of the things is that perhaps you should only open it when the motor is already working, so that you don't start it. Whatever it is, we shall not go into this now. So this friend, Reform rabbi, says to me, don't you have other worries? That was an excellent question to ask. Don't you have more important worries? So I said to him, no. And I tell you why, because this is not a small matter. This is not even a triviality. The great thing, and that's the way how I experience, I said to him, is that when I stand on Shabbat in front of a fridge, instead that I automatically open it, take the milk out, or whatever it is, I have to think for a moment. What am I doing now? Am I strolling or am I walking? If I walk, I just open the fridge, take the thing out, throw the door back again, and it's all over. I don't take notice even of the fridge. Probably if my wife asks me afterwards if I went into the fridge to get something else, I have already forgotten. Because my mind was not at all busy. But on Shabbat, I have to think twice. Can I open it? Can I close it again? Whatever it is. I take notice of the moment that I do that particular act. Somebody once said like this, the Jewish tradition is a tradition of sanctifying trivialities. Of sanctifying trivialities. I once said, with tongue in cheek, but there's a lot of truth to that, we Jews have a fantastic thing, which nobody can do as well as we do. We can make a problem out of any solution. We are great in that. What the rest of the world takes for granted, we'll say, oh no, it's a problem, you can't just open your fridge. If you put in the morning your shoes on, you have to know that first you have to put your right one on, then your left one on, then you make a knot in your left one, and then in the right one. And the world will look to us and say, are you crazy? Don't you have any other problems? But you know what? The meaning is this. The meaning is that if you put on your shoes in the morning, and you have to think a moment how to put that shoe on, you take notice of the shoe. You take notice of the fact that you have a foot. You take notice of the fact that there's something fantastic called a shoe, which your great-great-great-grands probably didn't have. All these things are now taken for granted. And here suddenly, all of that, the Jewish tradition comes and says, wait a moment, there's nothing to be taken for granted. This is one big non-triviality. You know what this is? You can't be indifferent to this. This is requires your careful consideration, because that what you do every moment of your life, you should A, sanctify it. Nothing should not be sanctified. Secondly, by that you live much better. Who are the people who live the best way? The people who take notice every moment of what they do. I dare to say that people who take notice of everything they do, they enjoy life much more than you and I do. Because anything you don't put your mind on, you can't enjoy. Anything which you do put your mind on, you can enjoy, if you take the right attitude. But it's lost on us. And badly enough, let's be honest about it, I say this with all respect, it is even lost on many religious Jews today. Even they don't know anymore. Even when we do these things and we put on the shoe to the left and the right, we don't even think anymore about it. It's all automatic. It is the most dangerous thing of all things that can happen to a religious personality, if anything is to be taken for granted. The whole point is to stop and to say, wait a moment, what am I doing now at this particular hour, at this particular moment? Which triviality is really an issue of great importance? Because in this world, there are no trivialities. That's what we talked ourselves into. How can something be trivial if the second in which it happens never repeats itself again? Anything you and I do at this second, or in half an hour, you can never do it again. Why? Because you never can catch anymore the same second. That second is gone forever. That's an interesting thing about time. So or you do it now, or you do it never. Because the next moment you do it is not the same moment. If something only comes to you once, it means it must be incredibly important. Anything that repeats itself is less important. But nothing in this world repeats itself. Because any time when you do something again, it is in another moment. And most of the time it is in different circumstances as well. If we say, as we all do, including myself, I will do it tomorrow, yes, then what you are actually saying is, I'm going to do something completely different tomorrow, because tomorrow is not today. But our whole educational system has blocked this out and is no longer able to indeed make us aware of that. And that's what we need to contemplate about, because I think only then you can really understand the beauty of the Jewish tradition. And I say this in all honesty, one of the biggest problems today in Jewish education is that we don't get taught these things anymore in school, in our yeshivot or wherever it is, because even there things are taken for granted. And by that we lose out on the most important thing. I will add one more dimension to this, and then I will stop. You know, we are holding now in the 3 weeks. I'm very honest with you. I hate the 3 weeks. The moment that I can't listen anymore to music, and I have to be careful about this, and then on other days I can't eat meat anymore, and things like that, it disturbs me. I don't like it. I don't enjoy it. But it's wrong. I'll tell you why it is wrong. Why I am wrong. And that is this. The whole purpose of the 3 weeks is obviously to create some discomfort in our lives. Because we, especially we living today, you cannot imagine how comfortable we are living compared to our grandparents or to our great-great-great-grandparents. What you would consider today to be a terrible condition to live under was a few hundred years considered to be a royal way of living. Because it is purely depending where you're holding in your comfort. You know that the kings of thousands of years ago, even a few hundred years ago, how did they get out of their bed in the morning? First of all, what kind of bed did they have? You live on a bed, very comfortable, very carefully balanced out, everything is done so that you, when you lie down, it is really marvelous, you can really relax. Remind yourself that 150 years ago there was nothing like that. Most of the beds were hard, were difficult, were painful, very hard to fall asleep that way, because they didn't have the materials, they didn't have the technology to create the kind of a mattress which we have today. And then you get in the morning out of your bed. Do you know how many layers you use before you prepare to get out of your bed? You get out of your bed, the first thing what you do is you put your sock on. Remember that a few hundred years nobody had any socks. After you put your socks on, you probably put yourself into, how do you call this in English? A sandal, you know, something in house, you think, which is made of some kind of soft stuff, which is made from, or wool or something else, which is itself warming, which has several layers inside to make sure that you don't get cold. There are layers outside, there are layers inside. There is gummy or plastic under it, so that when you walk, you don't walk on a piece of wood, but you actually walk softly. That's the way how you get out. But then on top of that, you walk on carpet, which is again very soft. Under the carpet, there is another lining, which makes it even softer. Under that is probably some other stuff, which I don't know how you call it, which again makes it possible that it all moves, because you should not at all feel anywhere a little uncomfortable when you get out of your bed. And then obviously you only get out of your bed if the central heating is working. Yes? And you and I take that for granted. And probably, I speak first of all about myself, you know, many of these things, if I would have today to live without it, would be very hard. My grandparents lived without all that. They never knew about the existence of these things. Can you imagine to live without cars? Can we imagine today to live without emails? With the computer? I still remember the days when there was no email. I never missed it, because it was not there. But now, if my email breaks down, that is a disaster. A few years ago, it was not a disaster because it was not there. The same thing is true if I have to bring my car into garage because it has to be repaired. What am I going to do one day without my car? My grandparents and great-grandparents and great-grandparents and yours as well always were without the car. So what we have been doing is we have been building and building, and we're building more and more, and I'm not saying that we should not do that. But we should take it into perspective. We should say to ourselves, okay, we're building, we're more comfort and more comfort and more comfort. By that, by the way, we're getting much more lazy as well in many ways, right? And then if, God forbid, it's taken away from us, we really are in distress and we get a depression and things like that. It's not for nothing that so many more people today to go to psychiatrists than a few hundred years ago. Because we have built this whole superficial or better artificial way of living, which is marvelous, till it breaks down. And what do the 3 weeks do? It breaks it a little bit down. It says, sorry, today no music. I'm a music lover. To live without music is for me personally very difficult. But the moment that the 3 weeks start, I can't listen to music anymore. So discomfort. That's a marvelous message. And that is that after the 3 weeks are over and I hear my music again, I first of all appreciate it much more because I didn't take it for granted for 3 weeks. I get a reminder. And so with all the other things. Many of us eat meat every day. Imagine that your great-grandparents, I can tell you for sure, probably didn't even eat meat once a week. Because only very, very rich people could afford something like that. We eat it every day. 3 weeks come and you know, 9 days come and says, well, you know, for 9 days, make it a little bit uncomfortable. Do I like it? No, but that's exactly the point why it is there. If I would like it, it has no purpose. The fact that I don't like it is the whole purpose. So therefore, when I hate it or if I don't like it, that is exactly why I should somehow do something about it or keep something of all that, because by that I don't fall into the problem of, let's give it another name, of indifference. Because we became incredibly indifferent to most of the things which we have today. And indifference is perhaps the greatest scandal which can happen to man. You know, it says that in Sefer Yecheskel, in the book of Ezekiel, where he speaks about the third temple, it says over there that if you would walk into the temple through the north gate, you must leave the temple through the south gate. If you walk in from the west, you must leave it on the east side. You're never allowed to go twice through the same gate. I ask you a question. Why not? Why would you not be allowed to go twice through the same gate? Anybody a suggestion?
The purpose is to get to the
the purpose is to get something out of it, and why then not going twice through the same gate?
Because if you go in and return to the same gate, you didn't get anywhere further.
You didn't get anywhere further, true, yes.
You should recognize that you've been changed, or something did change, and something occurred.
Yeah. Yes.
If you keep walking back and forth through the same door, then eventually the surroundings are going to become so familiar that even if you are strolling, you won't. You'll still be just walking.
Exactly. It's an English expression, I think it goes, familiarity breeds content. Right? Whatever I see twice or more, I lose my connection with it, I take it for granted, I become indifferent to it. So the Torah says when you're in the temple, which is the place where you should never be indifferent about anything. That's the whole purpose of this place. Don't ever see things twice. Whatever you see, see it as being totally amazed by it. You stand in wonder, because amazement and wonder is the ultimate way of living your life. Whatever you are amazed about, wherever you stand in wonder, you say, wow, then you live. If you just say, oh, I saw this yesterday as well, you don't live. If you say, oh, I saw it yesterday as well, you're walking. If you say, wow, whew, that's unbelievable, you're strolling. That's the difference. By the way, this is the reason, I think, why we make, why, for example, when we, when I take an apple or any object, yes, I'm not allowed to put it just like that into my mouth. I have to make a bracha. What is the meaning of a bracha? I tell you, the Hebrew, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Borei Peri Eitz, right, is the translation of another word. In English. You know what that word is? Wow. The Hebrew translation of the word wow is Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam Borei Peri Haetz. Because what is a blessing? A blessing is a statement of amazement. A blessing is a, wow, I'm able to eat an apple. Wow, I'm able to enjoy the apple. I'm able to have this going into my body, and there's all sorts of tremendous things to me which are all very wondrous and very miraculous. Wow. So the Hebrew is Baruch Atah Hashem. So the whole point here is, don't ever walk, and definitely don't run, but stroll. And the more you stroll in life, the more you take notice of every moment that you're doing. And then you only start to live life. I once saw somewhere, obviously as a joke, a picture was in a cemetery, where there was a matseva, there was an, how do you call this in English? A tombstone. And on the tombstone it said, buried in 1960, died in 1922. You understand? Some people are dead for years when they still walk around. Why? Because they never lived. They were just walking. How many years do we really live? As I said before, that's the difference. I wish all of you that you should be strolling through life as much as possible, not just on Shabbat, but start at least with Shabbat. Don't carry, because one day it will be that you may even realize that to carry in the weekdays is something which should be a form of strolling and no longer just that you are the means of getting somewhere.
I have a question. So what about when you're like dating yourself, or like when you're in a relationship? Sorry.
That's fine. That's normal.
But are you supposed to like think of like where the relationship is going, where the relationship is walking? Instead, like to know if it's really gonna, you know what I mean? If it's really gonna go to marriage or if it's really not. Like I can say like most of us like when we date or whatever, we have the tendency to like see if this is the real thing or not, if it's really going somewhere. So is that walking or is that stalling?
If you are walking into a marriage, you can be sure. If you're walking into a marriage, you can be sure your marriage will break down. If you stroll into a marriage, that means to say you take notice of the person, not because the way how he just looks, and how well he's dressed, and what kind of hat he's got on his head, right? But you look to the strolling of his, that is the inner personality, the quality of the person, you can make a marvelous marriage. That doesn't mean to say that the external side doesn't play a role. It does. Jewish law says that you must feel attractive physically also to that person. But it all should always have a higher meaning as well.
I'm saying, like, when you see the future, not when you see the future, but when you think of the future, is that surely?
No, it's absolutely fine to think about the future, but the question is, what do you mean by future?
I'm saying if it has the potential of, like,
absolutely.
So
if
that's
strong.
That's thinking
about absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Any questions, observations, disagreements?
That's
true.
About now, if anybody has a question for
I have already done Mari, so if you want
that
thing.
Yeah, that's right.
So, would you mind explaining again the fact that we have the ability to make an Eruv?
Yeah.
So.
I didn't really go into that.
Right. How does
the Eruv is really a little bit of a problem because it, it takes a little bit away from the whole
right.
meaning of Shalom. So the whole point why we say that Shalom.